Welcome to Module 4. Today's Lesson 17 is about the members of the United Nations. In this module, we're going to gradually drill down from the macro organizational levels to the micro or person-to-person levels of the United Nations. And so we'll end up with a look at what might be called NGO diplomacy, even though we are beginning with a focus on the diplomatic missions of the United Nations. So there are a few layers to this, and we're not going to do it all in one session, but we're going to take it just gradually, a step at a time, to reach that last micro level. And from there on in, then in the next module, Module 5, we'll really start to dig into the advocacy component and the role of NGOs in that particular nature of relationship at the United Nations. So who are the members of the United Nations? How do you become a member? Well, according to the Charter, Chapter 2, Article 4, it's open to all peace-loving states that accept the obligations contained in the United Nations Charter and, in the judgment of the organization, are able to carry out these obligations. Now, how does a new state actually get recognized? States are admitted to membership in the United Nations by a decision of the General Assembly, and this decision is made upon the recommendation of the Security Council. So what has to happen first? The procedure is briefly as follows. First, the state submits an application to the Secretary General. He is responsible as the central person to receive, on behalf of the United Nations, such a document. And that's a letter formally stating that it accepts the obligations under the Charter. Next, it goes to the Security Council and they consider the application. And any recommendation for admission must receive an affirmative vote of at least 9 of the 15 members of the Council, provided that all of the P5, that's China, France, Russia, Great Britain, and Northern Ireland, and the United States of America have voted to approve that country. Once that process is completed, then the Security Council recommends admission. So that recommendation then goes off to the General Assembly for its consideration. Then a member state must receive 2/3 of a majority vote in order to be accepted as a member. So that's basically the way it works. And membership of that country is effective the date the resolution for admission is adopted by the General Assembly. And these are the permanent missions to the United Nations. And there are permanent observers. Now, the status of a permanent observer is based purely on practice. And there are no provisions for it in the United Nations Charter whatsoever. But the practice dates back to 1946, when the Swiss government was offered the position of a permanent observer to the United Nations. And it was an observer all the way through until 2002, at which point it decided to become a UN member. So there are permanent observers that are non-member states. Perhaps they have been participants in some of the agencies or programs and therefore can be included as an observer state. And these include today the Holy See and the permanent observer of Palestine to the United Nations. And there are intergovernmental organizations that are observers in the work and annual sessions of the General Assembly. And they have free access to most meetings and to the relevant documentation of the United Nations. And there are also intergovernmental organizations that have permanent observer status, as well as some other entities. Now, intergovernmental organizations are such as, you know, the Caribbean Community, the African Union, the European Union, and such. And some of the other, quote-unquote, entities include the International Red Cross, the Interparliamentary Union, and the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. So what exactly are countries joining when they join the United Nations. Well, the United Nations is neither a state nor a government. It's not the world's government. It's an organization of independent states, and you could call the United Nations the preeminent meeting place or association for the world's governments. But in short, what you could say is that countries are joining an international organization that is focused on maintaining international peace and security, developing friendly cooperation between countries, a place that they go to solve international problems, respecting human rights together, and also it's an organization that serves as the focal point for peaceful national level activities. Now, as such, the United Nations itself does not determine whether or not a country is a country. It's not in the business of, so to speak, nation building or nation creating. It is, however, in a position to allow states, existing countries, to join its ranks. Now I want to just run very quickly through the main bodies, pointing out again or highlighting the membership detail. In the Security Council, there are 5 permanent members. It also has 10 non-permanent members. Now, each one of those non-permanent members has a 2-year term, and the terms expire on the 31st of December on the year that their term ends. Now, there's an overlap every year, so that there are 5 retiring non-permanent members and 5 new incoming members, so that there is as much continuity as is possible while respecting the cycling through of different countries in the Security Council. The Economic and Social Council, they have 54 members. Each of those members are elected for 3-year terms by the General Assembly, and again, usually there is regional consideration for the election of members, as there is in the Security Council. Their terms also expire on the 31st of December of the year that their particular term ends. As for the members of the International Court of Justice, there are 15 members of the Court of Justice, and they're elected for 9-year terms. And again, by the General Assembly and the Security Council. Their terms also expire on the 31st of December of the year that their term ends. Of the 15 judges of the ICJ, 1 is the president and 1 is the vice president. The court also designates a registrar as the secretary of the ICJ, and he has to assist him, the secretariat or registry. So at the moment you can see the president is from Japan, the vice president from Slovakia, and then you have your judges from, again, regionally distributed throughout the world. Membership dues. As for any organization or association, there needs to be a way to sustain the organization and its basic functioning. And these are done through membership dues. So the expenses of the organization, according to the UN Charter, Article 17 and Paragraph 2, the expenses of the organization shall be borne by the members as apportioned by the General Assembly. What that means is that there is a committee on contributions and as a part of the General Assembly, and that meets annually for 3 to 4 weeks, usually in June of the year, and they advise the General Assembly on things like apportionment under Article 17. They make assessments for new members as they're coming into the United Nations. They deal with the appeals by members for changes of assessments because of the different situations and changing circumstances of the nations, and also action to be taken with regard to Article 19. Now, Article 19, here we go. Article 19 says that a member of the United Nations which is in arrears in the payment of its financial contributions to the organization shall have no vote in the General Assembly if the amount of its arrears equals or exceeds the amount of contribution due from it for the preceding 2 full years. The General Assembly may nevertheless permit such a member to vote if it is satisfied that the failure to pay is due to conditions beyond the control of the member. And that is this discussion of actions to be taken. In other words, a member state, if they haven't paid their dues, can still appeal to the Committee on Contributions to say, look, circumstances in my country have led to the fact that we are unable to pay at this time. However, we really believe that we should not be held accountable for this. These are circumstances beyond our control. We still want to be able to vote. We still want to be an active member of the United Nations. And the circumstances for that are considered, again, by the Committee on Contributions. It could be a situation such as Haiti had with natural disaster. It could be war or any other kind of issue, significant issue. FYI, the next session of the Contribution Committee on Contributions is from the 6th to the 24th of June in 2011. So you can see that the organization does function like many associations and NGOs. They have to be concerned about what their mission is, how they're going to fulfill it, and how they can have the resources that they need to be able to fulfill it. And they always have to turn back to their own members in order to get that funding or the resources that they need, even if it's the resources such as the peacekeeping troops. The peacekeeping troops do not come from any magical place. They come from the members. So the member states have to decide whether or not they will contribute troops to the peacekeeping organization. If so, how many, how quickly they can get them there, how much an individual member state can afford to fund peacekeepers, because the UN itself does not come up with the funding per se. Again, the United Nations always has to turn back to its members in order to be able to accomplish its goals and its missions. So you can see that in many respects, the United Nations, in some respects, is simply a global level association. And it still has many of the concerns and issues, frustrations and aspirations, disappointments and successes that NGOs do. Only, of course, on a much larger scale. Now here, I'm going to run through some of the permanent observers. Previously, I did mention a couple of them, but I want you to get a bit more of a sense of the numbers and scope of organizations, international organizations, that are observers. Now, first of all, there are some entities. In other words, they're not intergovernmental organizations per se, such as the International Committee of the Red Cross and the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. Also, you've got the Interparliamentary Union. Again, that's not made up of governments, but of parliamentarians from various nations around the world. Then there's the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. They're the four main entities that have permanent observer status. Then you've got the non-member states. That's the Holy See and Palestine. Palestine, even not quite having the status of a country, but we won't go into the details here. But then there are many intergovernmental organizations, and just to kind of scoot through some of them, more of them you can find in the UN Blue Book. Again, the link for that is below. And there are organizations, intergovernmental organizations such as African Union, clearly intergovernmental and focused on political issues and the political relationship. And then you've also got other intergovernmental organizations that focus on other issues such as the ICC, the International Criminal Court, Interpol, the International Development Law Organization. So they're dealing with development law. You've got Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance. You've got an organization dealing with migration, those of the French-speaking countries, dealing with the Seabed Authority, the Tribunal for the Law of the Sea. You've got the International Union for the Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources, the League of Arab States, the Organization of Islamic Conference, Partners in Population Development, and I think you'll find that there are many more there. Do take a look again in the Blue Book at the section on permanent observers. Now, today's homework. I want you just to think a little bit, how does the UN compare with other membership organizations, even perhaps some of those that you're a part of? What is the same and what is different? Does your own experience in an association or an organization, does it give you some understanding of perhaps the challenges and the difficulties and the potential that lies within the United Nations? What are the similarities and what are the differences? Now, given that the United Nations is not a government, what are your thoughts about there being a world government? Now, for this, there's no right and no wrong. You don't have to post your answers for the rest of the world to see, but I just want you to think about the pros and cons of there being a world government. Do you really want one? Is now the time for that? This is a huge topic, and we're actually not going to engage in it any more than here, where I just simply want you to think from what you see and know about what might need to be there for a global government, and or what would be the serious dangers of having such, and therefore what kind of value does that give to the United Nations even as it is. Given that the UN is an agreement of nations to work together for peace and security, for good neighborliness, what do you think could make it work better than perhaps what it is? What would you add in? What would you take out? How would you go about persuading others that these things are needed or that they need to be removed? Today we took time to look at the member states from the perspective of being a member of an organization, their responsibilities, and a little bit more about the task of the United Nations as a global level, but nevertheless association that has its own challenges of enabling that association to work and to work well. I hope that this has added to your perspective and understanding of the United Nations. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow to continue to broaden and deepen your understanding of the United Nations with the clear intent that as this understanding grows, you can also find more ways, and for you and your organization, more effective ways to work with the United Nations. See you tomorrow.